Well, whatever our thoughts are about how many refugees we take, their future here is another story. I mean, there are many cases of migrants, refugees from Europe post-World War II and beyond, who've had spectacular careers in Australia. Frank Lowy is perhaps the most cited example. Do the same conditions still apply, though? Could people arrive with nothing and move through the ranks? Now, as you know, we've been speaking quite a lot in the last few weeks about social mobility in the US, where high prison rates of particularly young, poorly educated African-American men is effectively a social policy by default for low-income men, we were told. And in the UK, the exclusiveness of education limits people's capacity to reach the society's genuinely influential positions. So many young Brits had aspirations but not expectations about moving beyond their circumstances. So what's the situation here? Can someone who attends a low-ranking school realistically both aspire to and achieve their ambitions? Well, Andrew Lee's devoted quite a lot of time to examining these questions. He's a federal Labor MP now, but before his time in politics, he was Professor of Economics at the ANU, where social policy and education were his keen interests. And he joins me now from the Canberra studio. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thanks, Geraldine.
What struck me from the interview with the former UK Labor MP, Alan Milburn, was his rising from very humble beginnings in a mining town in the north of England, the son of a single mother, to a Blair cabinet minister. And he said he couldn't do that today in the UK. Now, have we mirrored that pattern?
I don't think so, Geraldine. I mean, I tried to look at exactly the same question that Alan was looking at, which is whether it is harder to move from rags and riches in Australia now than it was a generation ago. And I couldn't see any evidence of that. I mean, you can tell stories that would go both ways. We've certainly had things that ought to make us more mobile, such as the movement away from fees in universities to mass education. And then we've had things that might go the other way, like, for example, the scrapping of inheritance taxes in the 1970s. But it turned out that Australia was about as socially mobile in the 2000s as it had been in the 1960s. Now, it's not to say that things couldn't be moving in a less mobile direction now. The problem with measuring this, of course, is that you only get to find out how things have changed as the kids grow up, hit the labour market and start to have earnings of their own.
Right, because you've tracked the golden times, undoubtedly, for sort of almost around the Western world post-World War II, and it started to shift around about 1980, you make the point, and I know you've made that elsewhere, but, I mean, if you were trying to forecast where we are now, like from the beginning of the 2000s, do you detect it has become harder?
Well, let's distinguish two things there, Geraldine. So I just said that Australia appears to be about as socially mobile for kids born in the 70s as for kids born back in the 40s and 50s. But the gap has increased. So the raw gap between rich and poor in Australia has widened, and that change, as you say, starts in about 1980. Australia becomes a more equal society from about the 20s through to 1980, and then the last generation has seen a big widening of the gap between rich and poor. And I guess my fear is that in the next generation, that might also make us a less mobile place, a place where what your parents do really does determine what you do.
You found that Scandinavian countries have greater social mobility, that being born on the wrong side of the tracks is barely a barrier at all. So what do they have that we don't?
Scandinavian countries have a lot of sort of common social services. So it ends up being fairly expensive. But for example, if you're in Sweden and you look at childcare in Sweden, it's available, it's provided by the public, almost as public schools are provided in Australia, much more public housing, much more generous levels of income support. That all comes at an economic cost. Very high taxes, and Sweden is perhaps one of the few places where you could have said that the taxes actually were so high that perhaps they were decreasing the total revenue take. I think there's costs of that system, but it does mean that whatever your parents do in Sweden, it makes almost no difference to what you do, except for the super rich.
And do they have targeted welfare to the same extent as we do? Because you also do highlight that as a very important and often goes unnoticed today. You said in a recent speech at the Sydney Institute, but that's critically important in determining distribution of our cake.
Yeah, I mean, they're much less targeted. If you take the work of Peter Whiteford at the University of New South Wales, he suggests that Australia's welfare state is actually the most targeted among the developed world. So we're very good at making sure that dollars go to the very poorest. I think there's been a number of important moves to make that happen. The means testing and asset testing of the pension in the 1980s was important. And we've also done a bit of means testing under the current government of certain programs to try and make sure that where you've got scarce government spending, it's going to those most in need.
In the UK discussion, Alan Milburn found that the top employers targeted really 19 only of the 115 universities. Do you know if it's the same here? I mean, we have our group of 8 universities, usually referred to as the sandstone universities. Is there quite such an emphasis on where you went to university to get one of the top jobs?
I suspect it's there as you go up to the most elite jobs, Geraldine. I mean, I haven't looked at the employers that Alan talks about, but I did years ago when I was a High Court associate do a study of the backgrounds of people who work for High Court judges. And it turned out in that study that High Court judges were essentially recruiting from 2 or 3 Australian universities. So it was almost impossible at that stage to be a High Court associate coming out of, say, the law program at the University of Wollongong, as many talented lawyers do.
Yes. And what about then the next stage on? Like at the moment, I just picked out of the Financial Review yesterday, blue-collar workers. This is actually new research that's come out, statistics showing that blue-collar workers were outpacing their suited counterparts in the salary stakes. The mining industry topped the nation for wages, an average of $2,173 a week, up 35% in the last 5 years. The nearest white-collar industry was financial services at $1,375 on average. So I wonder whether, notwithstanding that sort of High Court judge's decision, whether there are real changes in our midst that are going to fundamentally alter this equation.
There's certainly some very high salaries being earned in the mining sector, but you know, people are working, making sacrifices for those salaries. So they're living in places where often they have to be away from their families and friends, working long hours in pretty hot and tough environments. There's some sense in which I think that driving a truck in Karratha, we should probably regard a bit as playing for the Sydney Swans. It's a great career while you've got it, but most people will only have it for sort of 10 or 15 years of their life.
You don't really call that upward social mobility?
Well, it does provide mobility, but I think what that comparison that you've talked about from the Financial Review does is it compares the salary of somebody who will earn that wage for maybe 50 years with the salary of someone else who probably only earned that wage for a decade. So it's not exactly apples and apples comparisons. And that's where I come back to the sports star analogy.
Yes. I must say, one of the things that sort of changed me thinking about the fly-in, fly-out workers during our series last year on Western Australia, because I was sort of resolutely worried about them, until somebody made the point, this is one of the very few areas in Australian life where unskilled, these are not tradespeople, but unskilled people can actually get a genuine leg up for them and their family. And it did make me think that maybe it was, even if it is a sort of semi-one-off, you know, it's a sort of a moment in time, like for the next 20 years or something rather, that it actually would change Australia a bit.
Yes, I mean, I think we need to be proud particularly of any innovation that provides opportunities to people that didn't have them before. And so, you know, the other one I always think about is how much fun it is to go to a university graduation where most of the people graduating are the first in their family. So if you go to, say, a sandstone university graduation, it's full of people very politely clapping young Johnny and Susan for doing what grandma and grandpa did as well. If you go to a Besserbrick graduation, it is often a graduation where there are whoops and hollers and people jumping up in the air for glee at the fact that the kids have managed to make it through and been the first in their family, sometimes to finish university and school.
But you say, and finally, that it's still, and I'm really asking you to say, confirm or deny this, it's still progressive taxation that is the key lever in terms of determining a country's social mobility?
I don't think progressive taxation is central to mobility. I mean, I think it certainly affects inequality, and it's one of the reasons why the gap between rich and poor has risen. But if you want to make sure that where a kid is born doesn't determine where they end up, then it's about education. And it's about those early childhood investments, particularly targeted at the most disadvantaged kids. Then it's about making sure that we have super teachers in disadvantaged schools. Then it's about making sure that wherever you're going to school, you can make it to university. Those key education steps are really about making sure that we're the mobile society that I think Australians aspire to be.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Andrew Lee, the author of Disconnected and also the Federal Labor member for Fraser. He used to be a regular guest on Life Matters, if you recall. And I was quite disappointed, actually, when he entered politics and he couldn't continue. He was Professor of Economics at the Australian National University, and very much welcome your thoughts about that.